Welcome to Crosstalk Podcasts, where we do our part to inspire recovery, recovery from addiction, and discover a better way of life. Whether you're considering a life free from substance dependency or already on that path, Crosstalk, we're here for you. Each episode, we do a deep dive into the experience and stories of people who have walked the walk of recovery, alongside experts who tell us more about addiction and recovery and enhance our understanding of these fields. Our mission is simple: to help you navigate the challenges and celebrate the victories of your personal journey to a better way of life. So buckle up, let's hit the road as we embark on this transformative journey. Both you and I have some great people with us together today, because this is Crosstalk Podcasts. Welcome, everybody. Hello, Irene.
Hello.
What's going on today?
Thank you for that beautiful intro.
Yeah, cut it out. Cut it out.
You're so handsome today.
Really? It's probably the white shirt.
Yeah, I think it's the white shirt. Well, today I'd like to welcome an amazing woman who I, you know, met almost a year ago, I would say, maybe a little, actually less than a year ago. And I feel as though we're connected. I know that you've known her for a lot longer, but Christine, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
We're down in South Florida.
Yeah, I came down to Florida on Thursday to be involved with an event that I've been planning with some colleagues from work at Karen Treatment Centers.
You work with the Karen Treatment Centers.
I do. I work with Karen Treatment Centers.
And you're the alumni person that makes sure that everybody that leaves the Karen Treatment Centers knows one another, is connected, and hopefully stays sober.
Well, I'm one of a team. I'm not the only person, but
fine.
I'm one of five or six people, Karen's, I think, very unique in that they believe that when you leave treatment, not only do you have a great plan from your clinical team, but you also have a really wonderful plan and ways and opportunities to interact with the alumni team, but also with other alumni who have walked in the shoes that you might have been in when you're leaving. So we really do our best to get people connected and being able to lean into a community if they want to.
Well, I was there this weekend. Irene was there this weekend. We had a great alumni, kind of a gratitude weekend. And you were a big part of making sure everybody felt comfortable and, you know, did a good job of reconnecting and recharging. So I'm grateful for that. We're here to talk about you. Mm-hmm. Right? Why don't we get into it? Where did you start this whole thing? Where you give us a little bit of background on Christine D.
Sure. Well, I've worked at Karen for 3 years, but before that, I never in my wildest dreams thought that I would be working. I never thought that I would be in recovery. I never thought that I would be working in recovery. I never thought I'd be sitting in South Florida doing a podcast on recovery and sobriety. So, you know, when I got here, you know, I got here at 50. I got found recovery and sobriety at 50. So I had a long, somewhat successful, illustrious drinking career until it wasn't.
Illustrious.
Illustrious, you know, it worked for a long time. It served a lot of different purposes across my life. Even at the end, when it wasn't so great, it was still, you know, it was still serving something that I needed filled.
So where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania. And Pittsburgh has a very big sports culture. Mm. And along with sports culture comes a big drinking culture. And I was the oldest of three girls, and I grew up in Western Pennsylvania and like so many other places in the country. You know, I was at Steeler games at 7, having beer, you know, spilled on me, or like it just...
Who took you to the games?
Alcohol was always around. I went with my dad. I was the oldest of three girls. So if the weather dipped below a certain degrees, I got to go to the games with my dad.
And what happened if it warmed up?
My mom would go. Yeah, my mom would go. So Yeah, I was really fortunate. And yeah, so the culture in Pittsburgh is like it is so many other places, but there, you know, you have a beer quarter, a beer period, beer man knows your name, that kind of stuff.
So when you were seven, you had beers?
I did not have beers, but the guys in front of me did, and they'd spill their beer on your shoe. I guess what I'm saying is, like, I was always around. Alcohol was always around. You know, you walk through the parking lots, tailgates. I'm of an Italian. My family's of Italian, Irish, and French descent. So, you know, there was wine at every meal. And when I was a kid, I would have wine and water. Like, it was just part of my family culture.
I thought that the Irish don't drink at all.
My Irish side does not drink at all. There's some Irish drink and some Irish don't drink. And my Irish...
Well, I was joking, actually.
Oh, no, literally. No, some Irish do drink a lot. And then there are other families that they don't drink at all.
Wow.
And I really believe that the Irish that don't drink at all had some sort of traumatic alcoholic in their past. But my mom's Irish side of the family actually never touched alcohol. The French obviously drank culturally appropriate, and so did the Italian side. But, you know, I was the first one to, I'm the first one in my family who's in recovery.
Your sisters never got
memo. I mean, it's not to say that we didn't overindulge. The whole family overindulges, I think, to some degree. I'm the one who... It went a little bit. I didn't stop so much.
When did you start?
I was given a champagne cork to suck at my christening.
No way.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I mean. Like, it was culturally. I have a champagne bottle signed by my family for my daughters from their christening. They sucked on a champagne thing too. But I think my first hangover was at 13.
Tell us about that. So typically here on Crosstalk, we'll go through kind of where it all began.
Yeah.
And then just follow through to like what happened.
Yep.
You know, and then how did you decide to get help, which is at 50, which is crazy. So at 13?
You know, it's interesting because I wasn't like one of the drinker and the pot smokers in middle school. I remember a friend of mine showed up at the eighth grade dance and vomited all over the dean's office and got expelled that night from the eighth grade dance. I had friends that were a little bit older than me. So I had friends that were in high school and I used to always go over to their house. I mean, cause they were good friends of mine, neighborhood friends. Their dad was a judge and there was always alcohol there. Like, this judge had a keg of beer in his study and you went in there to get your cup filled.
Wow.
And it was considered to be and was a very safe place to go because you were at this judge's house. There was a police car in front. The mother would take people's car keys. You could always sleep over. But that's where I really had, and they were like, I was in eighth grade and they were probably in 10th, 11th and freshman in college. And you know, there were parties and I would have a couple of beers, but that the first hangover I remember was then. Cause I went out to their house to a party in like June after eighth grade and had to fly the next morning with my grandparents up to our summer where we went in the summertime. And I still remember that hangover.
Wow.
However many years later, that must have been in 1980. You
that
know?
Didn't stop you. Which I find so amazing about us, right? It's like we go from 0 to 60, but yet we don't think like, maybe this isn't for me.
Yeah, no, it didn't stop me. Yeah. You know, I wasn't someone who drank every day in high school and I never did drugs. I was very, very afraid of drugs. Mm-hmm. I have a uncle who just passed, who was only 10 years older than me, that was a heroin addict. Mm-hmm. And we saw that. And not that any heroin addict, anyone with a heroin issue is nice, but he was the kind of person that would like get himself into trouble and legal trouble and was like locked out of my grandparents' house and not welcome at events and would call and threaten my dad and steal from businesses and things like that. So it was frightening to somebody who was 14 to see their, you know, uncle doing that, when he was only 24.
So who's your dad's brother?
My dad's youngest brother. My dad was the oldest of five, and this uncle was the youngest. And then my other uncle had experimented with drugs while in medical school, just at a party. And it was a psychotropic, and he ended up being in a very, very serious accident several days later, had a psychotic break sort of, and was hit by a semi-tractor trailer on the turnpike and literally was hospitalized for a year or two. And this is in the early 60s and mid 60s, and had to learn how to walk again and talk again, and lost, not like a very, very serious, you know, probably should have killed him injury. And so my great uncle was a priest and stayed with him, this uncle, through his recovery and diarized it. And so when I turned 13 or 14, I don't know if I found it or if my dad gave it to me. I feel like my dad would not have given it to me just because he wouldn't have thought of it. Maybe my grandmother gave it to me and I read the diary. And so then that scared me sufficiently too. Like, you never know what you're getting.
That's why you didn't.
That's why I did not do drugs. I didn't care if you did drugs. Some of my best friends were the drug dealers at college, you know, like that. I did not, it was not a snobbery thing, but I was very afraid of the unpredictability, I think, of the drugs, of the potential. And I also truly believe, like, if you had a hit of marijuana, you'd become a heroin addict. Like that, I believed. I don't know if that's true or not. But alcohol I could control, you know, like I knew when I was a little too much. I knew when to slow down. I knew when to have a glass of water. I knew when to get myself home. I didn't get myself into strange situations.
You're talking about college years.
Until like college, and you know, stuff started to happen like college and on. But like definitely in high school, it was more of a fun, everybody else is doing it thing.
So how did it progress? Like, what did college look like?
I think I was probably a lot of fun.
That's so
funny. I did fine grade-wise. Like, I certainly, but I definitely never took 8 a.m. classes after my first semester because I was not going to be waking up.
But there were no other serious consequences?
I mean,
it just sounds like
There were, but like they were like normalized, right? So like I had a sexual assault. I was date raped in college, but I was date raped, right? Like I went to a party and I drank too much and then he didn't listen to me saying no. So I very much felt like that was normal.
And it was your fault.
And it was my fault. Mm.
Did he get in trouble?
No, I never reported it to anyone. I mean, I got pregnant from it too and had an abortion. And when I showed up at Karen and they asked me if I had any trauma, I said no. And they said, have you ever been raped? And I said, yeah, well, I was a date rape, so it's not really
just
a rape.
Just once.
I said, it's not, that doesn't really count. And they were like, are you sure? And I'm like, yeah, I'm sure. And, you know, I had an abortion and that was like in 19, whatever.
But otherwise, no trauma.
No, I mean.
No, I'm kidding.
Oh, yeah. No, right. I mean, and Jesus. I also had.
I know, right? She's.
But, you know.
I said
wasn't,
the same thing.
I wasn't I the no only. Trauma. I wasn't the only girl that happened to.
That doesn't make it.
No, not at all. But like, I still feel like that. I still feel like I'm still in process with that. That it wasn't my fault. I also, when I was a freshman, was dating a guy a year older than I was, who I knew from Pitts, from where I grew up. And when he probably had a substance problem. And when we broke up, like he hit me in the middle of a fraternity party on the dance floor.
Oh my God.
And it was like, well, that was my fault because I shouldn't have gone to the fraternity party. I should have known that he was going to be bothered by me being there. So it was always like, it was my problem. So I think there were things, you know, and were they fueled by alcohol? 100%. But I never had any DUIs. I never had any legal consequences. So therefore, you know, I came up, I adore my family, but I definitely grew up in a culture of if something bad or traumatic happened to you, it was sort of like, well, what did you do to get yourself into that situation?
It's interesting because it's pretty obvious when someone hits you.
Right.
There's no way that it could be your fault for putting your head in the place where his fist was. But that thinking is really it makes no sense. I mean, the thing with regard to the sexual assault is even worse. But
Well, I went to the. I mean, I still would say to you, well, I instigated him by going to the fraternity party with a fraternity brother of his and was dancing on the dance floor. Well,
you could have also said I was born. So had I not been born, 100%. I wouldn't have been in that situation.
But I don't think that's a unique situation for females to think that. And, you know, I think therefore, like a lot of my, it's funny because I see a therapist every week. And I think part of what I'm processing right now is like my relation. Now I'm starting to tie into like the relation, that thing that happened, both of those things that happened in college have turned into my inability to like truly trust and be vulnerable in a intimate, I want to say intimate because I have intimacy with women and other men, but like in a sexually intimate relationship. Mm-hmm. The guy that hit me did go to the dean. Like that did end up going to the dean because it was witnessed by a lot of people. And the school, which is an amazing school, you know, in the 80s was like, don't go to his fraternity house. So I kept probably drinking like that all through my 20s, and some people got married, you know, I don't know. I just kept, and I found myself in pharmaceutical, like in advertising and in client services. So like my job is to make people feel safe and heard and entertain and, comfortable, kind of not unlike what I do now kind of, but like alcohol is just a big thing culturally. Yeah. And, you know, I drank for being happy. I drank for being sad. I drank for being stressed. Like drinking like a glass of wine was always the answer for anything. You know, like, and I see that in my friends and family, like you're nervous about going to something, you have a glass of wine, you're feeling happy about something, you have a glass. I mean, it's kind, but like,
sense of relief.
I would just keep doing it. Right. Like I would, and I shouldn't say that. Very often there were people that had drank more than me, even in my family or my friends. And so I always was able to control it really well. And it was interesting because when I was in Karen, I said that I did this like big history of my drinking, and I said, but I could always control my drinking. And my counselor said, you know, anytime you use the word control in front of something to describe the relationship, it's not a good. It's probably one you should rethink that. And I was like, huh. No one has ever said that to me before.
So, and just go a little bit further. Why do you think that they thought the word control in front of it is a sign of the problem?
Sure. It's just not a healthy relationship. Like I control my wife. I control my husband. I control my daughter. Like that's like controlling something is not, I guess it means it can become out of control, or it's my willpower, or it's not a healthy relationship between it.
If you're not controlling it, it will become out of control.
Right. Yeah. And that went on for a really long time. And I knew that I drank. I mean, all of my friends drank. So many of, I shouldn't say this. The people I was in high school and went to college with, we all drank the same way, very similarly.
And that's why it makes it feel so normalized.
And it feels so normal, right?
Yeah.
Some of the friends I have now, like I have one of my best friends went to Penn State, and she has a glass of wine every now and then, but which I don't understand either. I still conceptually don't. I'm like, how are you only having half a glass of wine? She went to Penn State and didn't have a drink the whole time. She didn't start drinking until after college. Wow. And I'm like, how do you go to Penn State and not drink?
It makes no sense.
You kind of go to Penn State to drink.
Yeah.
Like, you know? So I was surrounded by people who drank like I did, you know.
So you're
like, know all the bartenders' names. Like the beer vendor in section C30 was like, "Hey, Chris, how are you?" And I'm like, "Hey, Bob, give me two." Like that, like,
right?
You know.
So you leave college, get a job out of college.
I get a job out of college.
You're 20.
22, maybe.
Directly into the pharmaceutical industry?
No, I worked in advertising, and then I did some venture capital work with some guys in Pittsburgh, some investment guys in Pittsburgh. And then I moved to New York for a guy. worked on a guy that I should have probably known was not worthy of moving to. You know, I always like associated myself with people that probably were not treating me the way that I should be treated. I was always fixing and taking care of, and the guys that really liked me and loved me for who I was, I probably thought I wasn't very worthy of that. And I, you know, I undermined it or blew up those relationships somehow.
Or maybe they weren't as interesting because
maybe
they were, you know, not as much excitement or
maybe, or they weren't
boring, nerdy.
No. I think it had a lot to do with, I'm learning now. That I think a lot of it had to do with, like, I don't feel worthy. So if you think I'm worthy, then there's something wrong. Like, I think I thought like there was something wrong with him. Like, I have mm-hmm. a very hard I still feel very unworthy. And I feel very, insecure is not the right word. I feel like I can always be doing something better. Unworthy is a good place for me to land on. That's where mm-hmm. we're doing a lot of the work right now with my therapist. And that all started at Karen. I never saw a therapist until I left Karen either, even though I worked in pharmaceuticals and told other people to see therapists all the time.
Isn't it so easy to tell people what mm-hmm. to do, how to live?
And for some reason, I was always like things were reinforced for me. So when I went into marriage counseling at some point, like the marriage counselor said to me, "You're good. He's not. When he gets himself some individual therapy, then I can see the two of you together." So things were like always reinforced that way, right? Like, I don't know how that happened, or maybe I present that persona. But like things were all, it was never my fault. It was always circumstantial, something else. It was always.
But I mean, you were pretty high from what I understand and what I know about you. You're very high functioning. I mean, I see even now, like, I wouldn't say I work with you, but seeing how you work at Karen and just in life is you're extremely, smart, you know, you know a lot of small pieces, like even to the point where like in event planning, small little details, like you can catch them. Mm-hmm. You're very detail oriented. You're very much like someone who can see the problem, take a bird's eye perspective almost, right? So, I mean, you probably were very high functioning and that's what people can see.
Thank you for that. I take that as a huge compliment. I really do. I think.
I'm very impressed by you, to be honest.
Oh, thank you. I was very high functioning.
Yeah. And now and you are just without alcohol.
But that's what I mean, I guess, by part of the concept. Like, I remember when I was doing some work with Link, this guy I adored at Karen, he and Reverend Jack asked a question like, what did you lose by being an alcoholic? And we were in a business setting. And all these people that I was in the group with were like, well, I lost this restaurant or this business or these clients. And I was like, I don't know that I've lost anything, but I think what I've lost is what I didn't achieve, you know, because I felt like, well, who knows? Maybe I would have been I don't know what I lost.
It's really, really a good observation. And I don't think anybody really knows what they missed.
I don't know what my potential was.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that applies, I think, to a greater and lesser extent to everybody. But, you know, the feeling that, you know, you're not capable or you don't have, you know, the skill set to do all the mm-hmm. things that you actually do accomplish. I understand that feeling. And you, this past weekend, you were a superstar and you weren't sure whether or not you were a superstar. I told you were. But you have to tell you were. That's something that, you know, it's an inside job.
It is definitely an inside job.
So I'm curious. I know you're in recovery. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that, you know, alcohol, your relationship with alcohol, while it was consistent and continual, and it was a part of every high, low, or in the middle, mm-hmm. when did it become something that, that reared its ugly head and became something that you knew you had an issue with?
Sure. So it was, I mean, it was progressive, definitely. It slowly was progressive, but it was progressive. And I think my family was concerned about me for a little while because I drank more than anybody else. Like I would finish the dinner dishes and pour a glass of vodka to go read my book. You know, most people would go to bed. But like someone else in my family might be doing that too, or putting like grappa in their coffee. And so I really wasn't the only person, but I definitely was the one who was hungover more, crankier more. Like I had all of that going on, but I was still pretty highly functioning. What really happened was when I got divorced, which was still not, according to a lot of people, my fault, because they thought he was in, you know, they don't think we were well suited.
When did you get married?
At 31.
And when did you get divorced?
At 10, like we had just celebrated our 10 year.
10 years. So yeah. Were you about 41 or
so? Yeah, around there. What I think really accelerated it to a point that was terrifying. I mean, and I'm also, I always joke around with the people in treatment. I'm a smart alcoholic. I moved to New York City 30 years ago. You can take the subway, you can take taxis and liquor stores deliver. So, you know.
Pretty smart.
You don't need to have, you don't get into DWIs and you don't get into things like that, right?
Thank God.
I know. Well, you know, yeah, thank God. I never killed anyone.
It's so funny. People will tell me stories of like, you know, they went to different liquor stores.
Yeah. No, oh, I have.
Not. Oh, you have? Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
No, not me. I was loyal. I wanted to make sure that I was a good customer. It's and funny. I didn't even think they would be judging. Like, I didn't even think two things about it. I was like, this is my liquor store.
Did you have multiple liquor stores?
Of course. I mean, I think.
How many?
Doesn't everybody?
I'm not sure.
There are probably six walking distance to me. There are probably six walking distance to me.
So you had six liquor stores?
Probably. I mean, and I would go to, because I didn't want them to see how much I was drinking.
Well, you were controlling it.
And my dogs knew them all, because they all treat the dogs. Like when I came home from Karen, we had a little bit of reprogramming with my dogs, because we would go out for a walk and they would, yeah. But I mean, at the end, wow. I was going to a liquor store and like drinking a bottle of something before I got home, because I didn't want to see. I mean, it was like, I was the old lady in Brooklyn drinking on this, like it was not good at the end. But like what I think happened, and I, you know, I was in a pretty stressful job. I had a partner who drank a lot too. Like it was normal for us to, after work, go to, and he lived near me. We would take the same subway home together. It would be normal for us to go to like one of the fancy bars and have two or three old fashions before, in an hour before we got on the subway.
I felt that was very normal in New York. Did you have that culture at all? Because I felt I went to a couple of the same bars with the same friends and we drank two or three, right. You know.
Girls, I'm sorry, but I don't think this is exactly normal. I think it's normal for people like us.
I don't think it's normal either.
It's definitely not the rule. People go to restaurants, I think general people, and they order a glass of wine. And they leave, and there's a half a glass left in the glass of wine. I don't understand that at all, but
I think that having like three old fashions, which are basically or martinis, three or four martinis before you get on the subway to go home and have dinner with your kids is not normal. Because then I would go home and have a bottle of wine, and then I would go, then I would have like another drink after dinner. So that was normal. Like, and my work partner drank like that too, but he might not have had a bottle of wine when he got home, but I did.
So at 41, you get divorced, and that's when drinking accelerated.
Maybe because I had more free time. I mean, I would drink because I was bored, or I guess so. I don't know. It just continued to. I was such a heavy drinker. Like, I'm not sure what the answer is, but I do know what happened is that when my daughter, I have two daughters, and one of them developed an eating disorder. And even before the eating disorder came into the house, she had very severe anxiety. And my solution to dealing with that was to have some drinks. So I even remember, you know, I don't know why I was thinking of this. Probably someone asked me to reflect on something. Like, we live on a multi-story house. So my kids at some point didn't like me staying downstairs when they went to bed after we got to, I don't know why. And so I would bring the wine bottle up to my bedroom. And my thing was, my mom would be like, why are you drinking in your, and I'm like, well, my kids want me in the bed. They don't want me downstairs. And it's only 8 o'clock and I still want a glass of wine while I watch whatever. And that was my coping. I mean, I thought that that was normal. I don't think that's normal now.
Justifications.
Yeah. I don't think it's normal to bring a bottle of wine up to my bedroom. But my daughter developed an eating disorder and she had the anxiety. So I would just drink to calm myself down. I'm a big, like, amazing in this. I mean, I'm amazing in crisis situations. I really am. Like, you need to go to the hospital, call me and I'll take you and you can be bleeding out.
What happens when it's over?
When it's over, I like go into the bathroom with a bottle of vodka and drink. So I would always be really good.
I identify with that.
And in the urgent situation, and then I would be kind of a
so
bit
how many
of a
years
mess.
Ago are we talking about when things accelerated?
So Emma, so if you ask my children, I was not an alcoholic before 2015, which is hilarious. Because I certainly was. But 2016 is when my daughter, older daughter, developed an eating disorder. And it became very severe and life-threatening, honestly. And so those 2 or 3 years when it developed and when we started to realize what was really happening, or I realized what was really happening. She was in 8th, 9th, and 10th grade. We did a treatment at home. We did a therapeutic treatment at home where we tried to deal with it at home. And we had a team of special, I found help. We had a treatment team, but the parent and the mother, in my case, because I was divorced, was basically the doctor and responsible for the food and responsible for making sure she had enough calories. And my ex-husband and I were not necessarily well aligned. Looking back on it, I now actually counsel other families. Like, it's not a good thing to do if you're a divorced mom working full. It was almost an impossible situation. Yeah. But when you have a sick child and you're a people pleaser and you're a fixer, like the shame that I had for not being able to take care of my child, and the fear for everything. Like, I would literally, like, the last meal would be over and I would drink myself to oblivion.
That's how you dealt with it.
I probably used to always pass out every night. Like, I was thought TiVo was the, you remember TiVo? I was so happy when TiVo came out. I was like, oh, I can fall asleep and watch the end of the show the next morning. Like, I was definitely like passing out or falling asleep or browning out or whatever you want to call it for a long time. But like when this happened to my daughter, I wanted to black out, not wake up, not dream, not think, not anything. So my alcohol use became
rampant.
It ramped up and it was dangerous. And like my children have told me they would put a mirror in front of my mouth. I might start to cry. They would put a mirror in front of my face to see if I was breathing. My God. I mean, I was passed out. And not only was I passed out, like before I would pass out, there would be like, if I didn't want to say my daughter's name, like she would not finish her meal. It would end up in verbal altercations, or I would throw a plate of food, or I would like, it was.
Because if the situation wasn't being controlled as you wanted it to be.
Right. Like you can't.
Well, she was trying to control it. And I know
dealt with eating disorder.
Behavior, you know, you try to control everything, and that's how you control it. You control it by either not eating or binging or both, you know. And so you were doing the control in a different way. And
And I couldn't fix her. And she was watching her get sicker. And I couldn't control my ex-husband. And they would go over to their dad's for the weekend. And she would lose 4 pounds, you know, she would,
oh God,
you know, because we were at this point, like going to the doctors every week to weigh her. So we were literally watching like all under the care of physician. I mean, it was just the intensity of the pressure of that in itself was like almost crippling. Meanwhile, I'm managing an agency with my partner, Chris, responsible for 200 people and $80 million. And like the amount of pressure that I look back on it now and realize that I was under was pretty insane. And my ex-husband does not financially, like I was the breadwinner. So I really felt that everything was on my shoulders and alcohol was the thing that helped to alleviate it.
And to your credit, I mean, I'm saying that really tongue in cheek. How the hell would you maintain your level of alcohol intake with all of this responsibility? That's almost a job in itself to be able to stay awake long enough to be able to do all these things and then to be able to put yourself into a state of oblivion. That's very hard work every day.
Probably.
It's impossible to really sustain that.
Yeah.
So speaking of which,
I was hungover every day. I at times would have to get off the subway to throw up. Like I was hungover every day.
What is
breaking point?
Yeah, what's the breaking point?